can see that illuminated sign that marks the end of the journey.
This vaccine will help us to get past this pandemic once and for all.
We need people to have faith that this vaccine is safe and that they should take it. The thing that's going to stop us from seeing the end of this pandemic are people going, oh, I'm not so sure.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Roger Hearing.
And good afternoon, I'm Caroline Hepke. Well, we begin, Roger, with the reopening of schools, because the Education Secretary has now announced an extra £400 million of funding to help children catch up in the classroom on time that they have missed during the pandemic. £300 million of money has already been announced by the government, and it's hoped that secondary schools in England will use that cash to run classes through the summer holidays.
Now, there have also been calls for the school day to be extended to help those who've been at home during the pandemic. The Education Secretary, Gavin Williamson, hasn't ruled that out.
We're looking at a whole range, a broad range of different options of how we can support schools, how we can support teachers, but most importantly, how we can support children.
Well, there have been concerns, of course, about teachers burning out if they have to keep on working throughout the holidays. Williamson has said it's up to head teachers to decide how to use the money. It could be used, for example, to pay teachers for overtime to do extra teaching. Now, the Scottish Government has outlined its proposed path out of lockdown the day after Boris Johnson set out his roadmap for England. First Minister Nicola Sturgeon's plan is more cautious on the reopening of schools, but does see a general reopening of the Scottish economy from the end of April. Joining us now is Christine Jardine, who's Liberal Democrat MP for Edinburgh West and the party's Treasury spokesperson. Christine, welcome to the programme. Thanks for being with us today. We do now have the plan for ending the Scottish lockdown. We also have Boris Johnson's scheme. Which of them makes more sense as far as you're concerned?
As far as I'm concerned, I think we need to keep following the evidence. I'm not sure either of them actually are. And if we follow the evidence, we should do what the scientists are telling us. If Boris Johnson had done that in the first place, we may not have had to have this other lockdown. The Scottish advice is actually very puzzling. Millions of people in this country have made untold sacrifices in the past year and been isolated from their families, you know, businesses shuttered. I walked along a high street in Edinburgh today and, you know, it's deserted. Boris's roadmap, he needs to get right this time. We can't go back. And the same has to be said of the Scottish Government. But the thing about the Scottish Government one is people don't understand it. At least we can see where Boris is coming from. In Scotland, you know, they were behind with the vaccines and they've managed to accelerate that. And they tell us now that they're doing a fantastic job. And, you know, the death rate is lower than anywhere else, you know, in the UK and all sorts of wonderful stories. If it's that good, why are we being kept in lockdown longer? And people are saying to me, what is she doing? Why are we having to stay in this? And the tiered system, just to explain, the tiered system, if we all come out of this and go into tier three, that means we're all still in lockdown. So there's dreadful confusion about exactly what it is the Scottish Government is seeing and what they're trying to do.
And the question of why there was not simply a united policy for the whole of the UK, which, you know, end to end is what, only 10 hours driving. Other countries are
frankly,
sort of... sorry?
Frankly, that's because the Scottish Government don't want to. You know, I mean, it's a political decision.
Yeah.
That's where people like me get very frustrated that it's not about, and this may not go down well with some people, but this is not always about what is best for the people of Scotland, despite what Nicola Sturgeon says on her, you know, podium every day on the BBC. It is often about the politics of simply showing to be different from England. And we hear SNP MPs in Westminster every day telling people across the United Kingdom in every debate about everything that no matter what it is, it's better in Scotland because they're doing it differently. No, it's not. And I think it's time that we started putting what is best for people before the politics of wanting another independence referendum. And frankly, it's very frustrating in Scotland at the moment.
Well, on that point, I mean, a lot of what's going to go on next is down to money. How long can we afford to support people in the way that we have done? Now, some of these things, of course, are regional. Some of them belong in Westminster. Some of them belong in Edinburgh. But we've got a budget next week from Rishi Sunak, some of which will have an effect on Scotland. What should the policy be on continued support? Furlough, business rates, universal credit uplift. Is it time to rethink those, to extend them further?
Well, first of all, I have to say everything Rishi Sunak says next week will have an impact on Scotland, because Scotland would not be in the position it's in at the moment if it was not getting the money from the UK Exchequer that the Scottish Government has to help businesses in Scotland. So we're all affected. This is a fallacy that the Scottish Government put about. What Rishi Sunak says next week will affect all of us. And I look at it from a different perspective. We cannot afford not to carry on with furlough. We cannot afford not to carry on with all the business schemes, at least until the end of this year. Because if we're going to come out of this with an economy which is in any way, any reasonable shape at all, then we have to do what Rishi Sunak himself said about a year ago now, whatever it takes. And this constant, you know, patchwork, you know, we'll have another 3 months of furlough. We'll extend it a month. Well, we'll have another 3 months. That's not good enough. Businesses need certainty. Businesses need to be able to plan. And he needs to extend it at least until the end of the year. But the other thing is, there are still millions of people in this country who have had no support whatsoever. Company directors, self-employed, a vast array of people, you know, taxi drivers, hairdressers, who are struggling in a lot of cases to get by through no fault of their own, simply because they've been following the rules. Now, what Rishi needs to do next week is something for those people. We need something big. We need to level the playing field. We've had the Amazons of this world. We've all turned to them. I've done it myself, because we can't get, you know, florists or dry cleaners or whatever. Everything is being consolidated. Now, something needs to be done to ensure that the profits that have been made by these huge companies is somehow redistributed. Not all of it, but just the excess profit is somehow redistributed to help save the small companies who are going to go under, the shops, the independent retailers, the all of these companies. Something has to be done to redistribute that.
Okay, I mean, that's done through the tax system, through HMRC, which is a progressive tax system in the UK. So then on that point, when should Rishi Sunak start thinking about how to pay for all of this? And more importantly, which taxes do you think he should focus on increasing? I mean, already corporation tax seems to be in the firing line, but things like stamp duty will perhaps be held down. So that leaves, you know, VAT and income tax.
Well, I would have hoped that Rishi Sunak's been thinking about this for a year. I really hope that he has. We haven't seen much sign of it, but I respect, you know, I respect the man, and I would hope that the government has been thinking for a year. How do we get out of this? What do we do at the end of it? He did say, I seem to remember right at the very beginning, his first statement where he outlined furlough. He did say that we may have to look at the tax system at the end of it. But to me, it's not about looking at individual taxes. If we start messing about with the tax system at the moment, that's going to cause even more confusion. Businesses have been hit with the double whammy of COVID-19, which, to be fair, the government couldn't have done very much to prevent. They haven't managed it very well, but they couldn't have prevented it. Brexit is now causing untold problems for lots of companies up and down the United Kingdom that they could have done something about. What we don't want to see, particularly small businesses landed with now, is more changes, more uncertainty, more red tape. They need a business rates relief, VAT relief, and think about how we get people out of this and reschedule tax in a way that they're not lumbered with huge debts at the end of it. Yeah.
Christine, I need to ask you about something that's very important in where you are at the moment, which is, of course, the ongoing scandal, I think we better describe it as, involving the former First Minister Alex Salmond and his successor Nicola Sturgeon, and the process that brought him into court. Of course, he was acquitted of all charges involving allegations of sexual abuse. What do you make of it? I mean, we've reached a stage where it seems to be getting to the point where Nicola Sturgeon herself may be under threat.
Well, you'll understand I'll have to be a bit circumspect in what I say, because there was a court case. Alex Salmond was cleared. He was acquitted. We have an ongoing inquiry at the Scottish Parliament. A committee of inquiry is looking at it, and one of my colleagues, Alex Paul Hamilton, is on that committee. But as a voter in Scotland and a member of the public, I'm looking at it absolutely aghast that we have this shambles going on and this infighting in the party the current party of government. It seems very bitter, very intense. There are spats on Twitter. It's really not healthy for the Scottish government. It's not healthy for Scotland if, at a time of national crisis, which we are at the moment, the Scottish National Party is focused on an argument and a bitter dispute between its former leader and its current leader. And one of the things that's come to the fore in the last couple of weeks was one of the women who was at the centre of the allegations, who made the allegations against the former First Minister, was interviewed in television and said that the women who were involved are all now finding this as traumatic as the court case, because they're being dragged through it all again. They're having to go through it. And they seem to have been forgotten in this. They seem to have been put to one side, and it's all political infighting. And the other point which was made yesterday by someone, I'm sorry, I forget who, was that the second person to be First Minister of Scotland was Henry McLeish, the Labour politician. And he had to resign because there was a mix-up over his rent for his constituency office. Nobody actually remembers what it was now, but Henry McLeish had to resign. That pales into insignificance in comparison to what we're seeing in the SNP at the moment. Right. Somebody soon will have to resign, I think.
Now let's have a look at what else is making news in the world of politics. We begin with the UK vaccine rollout, as fewer jabs have been administered in recent days, prompting concerns about supplies. The slowdown's being blamed on issues relating to some manufacturers. But England's Deputy Chief Medical Officer, Jonathan Van Tam, insists there are always going to be supply fluctuations with virus vaccines.
You do get kind of batch size variations, and that's kind of natural, and it's going to take a few months before the manufacturers really get into this very confident, very steady manufacturing routine.
Nearly 18 million people across the UK have now had their first jab.
This comes, though, as AstraZeneca is said to have told the EU that it will deliver less than half of the COVID vaccines that it committed to supply in the second quarter. Bloomberg sources confirm a report by Reuters that the British pharmaceutical company now plans to provide less than 90 million doses. That's down from an expected 180 million. That's after a similar shortfall in the first quarter as well. So much more difficult in terms of supply in the EU.
Meanwhile, the drip feed ahead of next week's budget continues. The Times now reporting Rishi Sunak's preparing to extend the stamp duty holiday by 3 months until the end of June. The government last year exempted most buyers from the levy if they completed their purchase before March 31st, 2021. The holiday enables people to save up to £15,000 in taxes. But the Chancellor's faced pressure to extend the deadline amid concerns it would create a cliff edge, jeopardising hundreds of thousands of sales. And now the Times says Sunak will move it to the end of June, bringing it into line with the easing of lockdown restrictions.
And now, we were talking about this earlier, the former Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond has decided not to appear before a committee investigating the Scottish Government's handling of complaints against him. Salmond had been due to give evidence but is angry that parts of his written statements were blanked out before being published. An investigation into sexual harassment claims against the ex-SNP leader was found to have been unlawful.
Well, let's pick up on this with Bloomberg Opinions columnist Therese Raphael, who joins us now. Therese, thanks for being with us again. It is a ferociously complicated subject, this whole battle between the former leader of the Scottish National Party and the current one. What has been happening this week and where is it going?
Well, I think to understand that battle, it's, you know, the first thing to say is that it can't end well for either. Because for Alex Salmond, what's on the line now is his legacy as the head of the Scottish National Party, indeed as the driving force behind the Scottish nationalist movement. And for Sturgeon, though, it's about her career and whether she can even, you know, maintain her current position. And the dispute this week is over, the investigation into allegations of sexual abuse by Salmond collapsed due to procedural blunders, which were said to give the appearance that the inquiry was prejudiced. Sturgeon claimed that she knew nothing of the investigation, but Salmon insists that she did know, and indeed they met at his home at a time when it was ongoing. Now, if she's found to have lied, and there's a review into that now, that's normally a resignation issue. So there is now a dispute over whether he appears before the, whether he'll give testimony. But, you know, regardless of what happens, I think this is very damaging, obviously for Salmond, but also for Sturgeon. And then the question becomes how that feeds through to the SNP's, you know, ultimate raison d'etre, which is to get another referendum and secede from the union.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is a kind of, and it's such a long-running issue too that has sort of been rumbling along. But look, on to other matters around the UK. The Northern Ireland Joint Committee is meeting for the first time today to try to work out the issue around the Brexit border. This is another huge sort of problem. Failure to agree something would actually ramp up tensions with implications for the broader trade relationship. And this goes back, of course, to the agreement between the UK and the EU on Brexit.
Yeah, I mean, we had that exchange of letters, very sort of testy exchange of letters between Michael Gove and Mauro Sefcovic a couple of weeks ago. They then met in person, they dialed down the tensions, and now this is quite a crucial meeting. The UK is asking for grace periods on checks and controls on goods going from GB, from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, such as food and parcels. Those grace periods are due to end in April, and the UK wants it extended until 2023. And the European Commission has charged Britain with failing to hold up its side of the withdrawal agreement, a deal, not putting in checks in place, not allowing the kinds of controls that would ensure that goods going to Northern Ireland don't go into the single market when they haven't complied with EU rules. So I think it's in the interest of both sides to make sure that they can arrive at some kind of agreement there, because as you say, the implication, if they cannot, is that it will again become a very charged political issue. It will have, it will affect so many other areas of the trade relationship that remain open. And that includes, you know, financial services, fisheries, which will have to be reviewed. And there are just lots of parts of elements of that trading agreement that was reached in December that are under constant review or that will be tweaked in various committees. So once this becomes political, once trust breaks down, it just, you know, it just can't help but affect other areas of the relationship.
But isn't there a fundamental problem with all this, Therese, which is structurally it's not likely to work? And this was seen way back, even when the referendum originally went through in 2016. You can't have no border and a border at the same time. And is it perhaps a recognition of reality that this it can't work as it is?
Yeah, I mean, the problem here is that, you know, Boris Johnson has never really publicly accepted that what he signed up to was a border down the Irish Sea. So he said that those in Northern Ireland won't feel a thing. They won't notice anything is different. And of course they have. And so this is largely about trying to erase those visible signs of a border. But, you know, as you say, that's going to be hard to do. There are, you know, new frictions. And the, you know, one way of trying to smooth things would be, you know, more kind of transfers to Northern Ireland. But obviously the Exchequer's got quite a lot on at the moment, and many demands on public funds. And meanwhile, we now have the unionists in Northern Ireland who, you know, have basically decided to just stop cooperating. Arlene Foster's described any extension as a sticking plaster. So that's, you know, there's a question of whether, you know, the whole thing becomes governable.
Yeah, I mean, look, Brandon Lewis, Cabinet Minister, saying that the government is focused on making the Northern Ireland Protocol work in a positive way. So, yeah, make of that what you will. Let's also talk, though, Therese, about the other big issue. And it's not just in the UK, but it's really globally. Are we or are we not going to end up with vaccine passports? Do they make sense? How would it be done? Lots of people chewing it over, and lots of people have already had vaccines in the UK. And as far as I know, you don't get to walk away with a piece of paper or even anything digital to tell people that you've had it. So what's the debate?
Yeah, it's a fascinating issue, and one the government initially sort of dismissed, but is now very, is now studying. Michael Gove is in charge of a review of that, and Boris Johnson admitted when he gave his roadmap that it's a very thorny issue. Mm. I mean, I think there are two issues. One is, do you have a vaccine passport for international travel? And in some ways, that's more straightforward because that's something that countries would impose, and the UK would simply have to enable by providing some kind of proof of inoculation. But the question that is, I think, really exercising the government now is whether, for domestic purposes, you would need some kind of proof of vaccination, so to enter a restaurant, to enter a pub, or to go to a sporting event. And, you know, there are fairness issues, and there are ethical issues. What do you do with people who haven't been vaccinated? And, you know, it may be less complicated than they initially thought. If they can, for example, use the NHS app to feed through vaccinations, that might be a way to do it. But they're going to also have to find a way for people who haven't been vaccinated or, you know, indeed who've refused the vaccine to still gain entry into these places, maybe through testing, and then it becomes a question of cost. So all of that is being reviewed now. But, you know, I, in a way, I think, you know, once we had the NHS test and trace app up, we've now accepted a certain degree of, you know, intrusion into our healthcare really profiles, and this is just, you know, potentially brings that one step further.
Yeah, and briefly, one can imagine the huge legal arguments, court cases that might arise, not least because some people, for medical reasons, can't have an injection. And also, of course, not everyone has the app. I mean, it seems full of holes, doesn't it, briefly?
Yeah, I think it's going to they're going to have to work out the technical issues, and then they're going to have to work very carefully through these privacy and potential legal issues, and that's why a review has been set up. But the government's acknowledged, you know, quite clearly that this is not a straightforward issue.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.